Warning: this podcast contains foul language, sexual situations, and discussions of drugs and drinking. Yeah.
Welcome to Fuck Shakespeare,
a podcast for the Shakespeareanly challenged.
And anyone who really enjoys some saucy dick jokes.
Teachers, we might insult you a little bit, sorry. Okay, everybody,
enjoy!
Hey, everybody.
I'm Erin.
This is Fuck Shakespeare.
But this is a special episode.
Because in celebration of Women's History Month, we have with us today Yvonne Hudson, who is the writer and performer of the solo show entitled Mrs. Shakespeare, Will's First and Last Love. Through sonnets, songs, and soliloquies from some 20 plays, Yvonne has woven together an imaginative script which celebrates the triumphs and tragedies of the world's most beloved playwright and his wife, Anne. The show introduces her as the mother of Shakespeare's children and the woman who bravely waited for him for more than two decades while he built a career in London. Yvonne continues to develop the script through ongoing research in Stratford-upon-Avon and London. Mrs. Shakespeare is the longest running solo project featuring the character of Anne Hathaway, a farmer's daughter who married the man from Stratford, who would later be destined to inform the English language and theater for ages. Yvonne conceived the show while earning a master's degree in theater arts and marketing the Three Rivers Shakespeare Festival at the University of Pittsburgh. Since then, she's performed it well over 100 times, including shows at historic venues such as the Tower of London, the Folger Shakespeare Library, a Prairie Opera House, the Rivers of Steel Pump House, and even off Broadway. Since 2005, she annually places the flowers at the Shakespeare statue at Pittsburgh's Carnegie Music Hall for the Bard's birthday. She does this in conjunction with Pittsburgh Shakespeare in the Parks, where she once appeared as Juliet's nurse. A Point Park University alumna, she also appears as Emily Dickinson, incorporating the show The Belle of Amherst together with her own compilation of the poet's work and correspondence. So welcome, Yvonne. That's quite a lot of wonderful things that you do. Tell us a little bit more.
I've been doing this for a long time. The show itself was originally my master's thesis project at the University of Pittsburgh when I was doing PR, as you said, and I wanted to have sort of an educational program to run out to ladies' lunches and organizations that would call us off season and say, can we have Hamlet for our event? And we would have to explain. Of course, you know, he's not here now. We were a summer company, but we raised awareness all year. So that was how it was born. And I was doing a lot of singing and voice study at that time. So I had a whole recital of Renaissance songs, songs that were in Shakespeare's plays, actually, woven into the thing. And some of them are still there. I kind of break into song a cappella once in a while, but mainly it's what you said, sonnets, songs, soliloquies, and my script weaving together biography and things I've known from my study of Anne Hathaway, Shakespeare, and then some dramatic license, of course.
So tell us about Anne Hathaway. Who is she? You know, why would the kids want to know about her? How does she contribute to?
I look at her as one of those somewhat forgotten women in women's history and literary history, and certainly a mystery in literary history, because in those times, people's lives weren't documented, of course, the way they are now. Yeah. So when I started my research, it was very clear there wasn't a whole lot to be known that was factual about her. I was happy that through the years, I've been able to confirm that I learned what there was to know, more or less. So when I created the piece, I took some dramatic license to help her tell her story through my script. While she was probably illiterate, like a lot of women in those times, I decided that in order to know what her husband was up to in London, right, that she might learn to read and that she would be able to, you know, toss some things back to him. So that was very helpful in the context of the piece. I find when I present it, people are very curious about her and her family. The correlations I found and bring to the surface about the man in the works, the life that you can find in the plays. So that's really been my labor of love and my focus as a sort of independent scholar over all these years.
So how did they meet Will and Ann, do you think? I mean, taking your license, it's fine.
Yeah, and I've thought about this a lot because I have, you know, some other projects I can tell you a little bit about. I think that their families might have known each other. The proximity of Stratford and where her father's farm was in Shottery, it's within walking distance. These are people who might have seen each other at market, at church, in the community. So that's not certainly out of, you know, factual possibility. Will was a young man and part of a large family. Anne was the oldest daughter in a family that essentially, you know, the kids were widowed, orphaned, I mean. She was taking care of her father initially and then her siblings. So this wasn't unusual at the time. For that reason, it wasn't unusual that she was 8 years older than him when they married. Statistically, research done in that region revealed, there's a whole book published about the census and the documents that show, you know, how people lived and died. And a lot of young women would take care of their families until their family could kind of let go of them, you know, and another daughter perhaps was old enough to take over. And that was Anne's situation.
How old were they each when they married?
She was 26 and he was 18. The older scholarship made a big fuss about this and used terms like shotgun wedding and that sort of thing.
Right.
When I started researching this in Hillman Library at the University of Pittsburgh, I couldn't find anything written about women, by women about her. It was all written by men. And some were very nasty. I remember Frank Harris, a literary critic for one, it was just awful. These were misogynistic viewpoints of a woman's life and purpose. Meantime, you know, they married, she was pregnant, but that wasn't really that unusual. Even in Shakespeare's plays, you see young couples, you know, consummating their relationships as part of the betrothal process. You know, it's something people did. They're going to be wed. So I don't think there was any shotgun. And she had a daughter later on. She had twins. And then he left. And he left her with this young family living in Henley Street at what is now known as the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. When I was there researching, I stood in the rooms and tried to envision how small the house was at that time. What you visit now appears to be larger than when all these people lived there. So she bore all of that and ended up there in Stratford, you know, taking care of his parents as they aged and him coming back and forth, maybe when there was plague or when there was Lent. And there she was, you know, literally keeping the home fires burning. So she did what a lot of women in those times did, keeping a house in very dangerous circumstances with fireplace, open hearth, plague, you name it, disease. That was what she did really well, apparently, because she outlived him by about 7 years, actually.
So I didn't know she took care of his parents. That's...
Well, yeah, they lived there. They were there when he wasn't, you know, and as they aged, she was the constant in the family. It wasn't until after their son's death, which we can talk about, Hamnet, one of the twins, that he bought a bigger and, you know, sort of more appropriate house for his means and for his family. So they were there in that small house on Henley Street for quite a while.
So you said shotgun, and we talked a little bit about that, but I'm interested because there are examples in the plays of some of these incidents. So I'm wondering if you have places where you see like her as a character in some ways. Like I'm thinking of the whole Claudio and Juliet being condemned for, you know, doing exactly that, for being pregnant mm-hmm. instead of being married in Measure for Measure. And so do you see places where you're like, oh, that must be Anne, you know, that he's talking about in the play?
Well, I've explored that a lot. I think his mother is reflected in the plays. I think his witty daughter, Susanna, who was probably better educated than Anne and married a doctor and married well, is probably in the plays. But I think Anne is sort of that country wife, maybe Mrs. Ford, Rosalind, because she was so resourceful and just had to do anything to survive and make things happen. And certainly, you know, the idealistic Juliet, I think. Wow. And then someone like Queen Catherine, who I'll share a little bit of what she had to say historically via Shakespeare, who was the first wife of Henry VIII, who the king divorced to change the church, and so he could be with Anne Boleyn. I think she had to stand up for herself. She had to be ready for anything when he eventually came home again. He came and went for about 23 years.
Do you think that that was like they made that plan together and she was okay with that? Or was it more like he was like, well, I'm out of here. And she was just like, wait.
Well, she probably wasn't empowered in a lot of ways. Women, of course, couldn't own property. She couldn't sort of have her own wealth. But while he was gone, she sure took care of his property and probably did things, as I say, Mrs. Shakespeare, I like to think she collected the rents on time, bought and stored the malt, did all the things he probably told her to keep doing, you know, maybe with some help from her brother and from a friend of the family who actually lived in New Place after they had the larger house. There was a boarder, you know, there were some male figures who were probably helpful to her. But I think it's some of both. We can't suppose what their relationship was exactly like because there weren't letters. There's not documentation about that. And I had to think a lot about that, about in the way to present her. You know, I thought, who wants to hear someone ranting and raving for an hour?
Yeah, yeah.
But I tried to explore him and what kind of woman would be waiting at home for him. And also by using, you know, a lot of his words to help her do that.
Yeah.
So that in that journey, she tries to learn more about what he's about and to continue to get him to know him better, even though he's not home. So while we don't know what they exactly agreed on, they somehow got through it and he came back. Granted, when his career was winding down and when the Globe Theater had actually burnt, when they were presenting the play Henry VIII, which was in honor of Queen Elizabeth, actually, more than anything else. It was a tribute to their queen, and the birth of Queen Elizabeth is a major point, you know, as at the end of the play. But that said, we don't know a lot. So in my piece, I suppose they sort of wrote to each other and there were messages going back and forth.
Yeah, so what were some of her duties? Like, what would she have been engaged in on a daily basis in terms of running that household?
Well, I was really interested to learn, you know, when I did some historical research on site and otherwise, that it was, as I said, kind of dangerous. Household accidents were a leading cause of death of women and children. Children could tumble into the open hearth, you know, a woman's skirt could catch on fire. There are all these things that could happen in the daily work of your keeping your home. When you had to arise, you know, and use the daylight early in the day to be able to see what you were doing and to do your work. If you had farm related duties, it was, you know, physically exhausting. Now, she had done that at home. So she was very capable. And I like to think maybe more physically able in some ways than him to do certain work. You know, his work ended up being with a quill pen, right? And he probably spent a lot of time in the tavern. She was someone I think of very much like my own grandmother, who inspired the character a lot. She ended up being a widow and a single mother who did a lot of the same kinds of things all of her life that Anne did. So I pulled on that personal experience of her life, thinking about Anne, and how does a woman do that? How does she do that alone? Not even sure if her husband's ever going to come back. So she did it on her own, and she was able to physically and somehow emotionally get through that. That's what women have done, right, for centuries.
For sure.
Just curious, do you think, from what you know, that he was considered a good match? I mean, when they married, obviously she was pregnant, but they were maybe betrothed before that, and was he...
Because his father was a problem character, wasn't he? He was like not really a good citizen of their town.
Well, he tried to be. I think he might have had a little bit too much strict at times. His father was the ale master at some point. He was the bailiff of the town. He seemed to hop around from profession to profession. and couldn't get a coat of arms for his family, which eventually William did. So that was a big thing that William was able to achieve for his family. I don't know that, for that reason, I'm not sure that people would have perceived someone from the Shakespeare family as a terrific match.
Right.
Exactly. These were not people of great means. You know, they had some property. His father also, of course, was a glover and tanned hides and worked with leather. Hence all of the glove references in Shakespeare's play. If I were a glove upon that cheek, there are a lot of them. And William would have been his apprentice and known all about that. So they managed, but William did a lot better. And when he bought the second largest house in Stratford, which he named New Place, that was a huge purchase in those times, maybe about 120 pounds back in the 1500s. And nothing like, you know, the home that he had grown up in with his parents and siblings.
How many siblings?
I believe there were five, several babies who died.
Yeah.
That ended up in the graveyard. There were several baby Jones before his sister Joan was born.
Oh, wow.
And granted, something I also considered about Anne is it's sort of a miracle that she and their twins even lived. Giving birth to twins in those times was very dangerous.
And very unusual, right?
Yeah, often they all wouldn't have made it. They all did. They all lived. So wow, what hardy, you know, farmer stock she must have come from. And, you know, midwives did all of this work, you know, helping women. And it's just amazing. So gynecologically, that would have been quite a challenge and might be, you know, something that affected their married life. Who knows? They make a reference to it in Shakespeare in Love. And they don't talk a whole lot about Anne in that movie, which I was very happy about. They sort of cast her aside like they did, you know, in so many other settings. But she did that. And twins are very prominent throughout his plays. They named them for their best friends, who were the twins' godparents, Judith and Hamnet Sadler. Mr. Sadler was a wool merchant. He lived on Sheep Street there in Stratford, probably blocks away from where Will grew up. And Hamnet died at age of 11, and we're not sure exactly why historically, that can't be documented, but that's tragic. It turned out he would have been the only one to carry on the Shakespeare name, the way the families grew or did not grow. It was that one boy who would have been, you know, the direct descendant. So that's heartbreaking. Then Will wrote Hamlet. The names were kind of interchangeable in those times. And when you experience and read or see Hamlet and listen to those words and the thoughts, you know, the inner thoughts of the playwright in that play, it informs so much of that experience.
So we had a theory that the ghost was maybe Shakespeare's father because he died at the same time around when Shakespeare was revamping the play. He did it a number of times, right? So he had different iterations of it. And so what do you think of that? Like maybe John Shakespeare coming and haunting?
Could be, you know, I wonder about their relationship and Shakespeare's persistence to, you know, get that coat of arms and do right by his family. I like to think that his father was proud of him and that he might not have understood the work he did on a daily basis, writing and producing plays and being the part owner of a theater, but that, wow, you know, he achieved something that Shakespeare's father could not do in his own lifetime. And, you know, as many fathers do, even when they don't understand your work, they have things they say to you all the time that, you know, you should do this and you shouldn't do that, maybe much like Polonius, you know, that I know my father certainly said things like that, that echo in my head. And he didn't always understand me either. So, you know,
what are you gonna do?
Still, you know, they might not understand your work, but there's a certain pride in your achievements and your success.
Yeah. Let's hope. Who are some of your favorite female characters in the plays and why is that?
Of course, I love all the ones who disguise themselves as men, because women couldn't go on the stage at that time. And it's just really interesting to me that Shakespeare, you know, put that twist on some of his characters. So of course, you know, as they say in Victor Victoria, it's a man playing a woman, pretending to be a man. And he sets that all up for these female characters who I think are just some of the most fascinating and empowered young women that you could have on stage. They would have originally, of course, been played by young men, sometimes who, as they say, whose voices hadn't broken yet. And that's just fascinating to me. So that would be Rosalind, Viola. Anything was possible, and the playwright could make that possible and have them do that. So I always wonder about the women in his life and how they were strong women. And then he took aspects of them and put them on stage.
So when people say, oh, Shakespeare's a misogynist because of things like the last speech of Taming of the Shrew and stuff, what would you say to them?
Back at Three River Shakespeare Festival, we were doing the production and someone was sitting behind me, I'll never forget this, while Kate was saying her speech at the end. You know, this would have been mid-1980s. And the woman was just having a fit. You know, there was a feminist woman sitting behind me. She was just having a fit over this speech and how she was interpreting what Kate was doing. So I thought about that a lot. And I had to decide if I was putting that speech in my solo show, what I would do with that. And I decided, feminist that I am, I decided, and I think I see this in the Zeffirelli movie. I feel like, you know, Kate was more in charge than some people give her credit for. I decided she's in charge. You know, she's going to make this work the way she needs to make it work. And I put that speech in my show in the context of her waiting for him to come home once more. And looking at her, you know, wedding vows, and that she's vowed to obey and be a good wife. What does that mean? Yet he's not here. You know, I don't know where he is. He's on sea and shore. He's everywhere that I'm not in my life. I'm in one place here in Stratford. So I put a little bit of a twist on it that way. And I let her rail a little bit. And I let her discover in the course of that speech that she has power and strength. She's in a position of power in some ways. And I feel like that's what Kate is really making happen for herself. I don't think it's as misogynist as people think, but you know, the thing is, these plays were not written in our time. They were not written when people were arguing about the ERA or when women were going back to work or going back to college or when people had, you know, taken roles that we know as things like Rosie the Riveter. You know, women hadn't done those things yet. So our context in the 20th and 21st century is very different than, you know, the lives of these women. But there's possibility in that. And what one of the things I love about Shakespeare, while, you know, people like to be reverent, there are so many different experiences that you can have with Shakespeare if you are bold to interpretation and to bring different things to them. And it's interesting how absolutely timeless it seems to be when people do that. It's just amazing. You could set Much Ado About Nothing at the end of World War I, you know, between two wars. Yeah. The men are coming back from war, but here's another one, you know, around the corner, alas. Yeah. How timely that seems right now.
Yeah.
And you can look at a play as complicated as Merchant of Venice and not just declare that it's an anti-Semitic play, but it reflected the times in which it was written. And unfortunately, it reflects the hatred and prejudice of unfortunately, all times. So I think that we shouldn't narrowly categorize these plays, but try to look at them in the historical context in which they were created, how people lived their lives, what society was like, and how hard, in that case, Merchant of Venice, it was to be a Jew. Apparently, it's still very challenging to be Jewish and to be different.
Yeah.
So Shakespeare in that play is, you know, exploring differences among people and how complicated it is for someone that might want to marry someone who's not of their own faith or marry someone of another gender. however we might interpret the layers of that.
I always make the argument for, you know, Shakespeare can't hate a character if he's put so many beautiful words in their mouth. So when you say he's a misogynist, but wait a minute, look at all these gorgeous speeches that he gives to women who get to speak for themselves.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So I cannot reconcile myself to Shakespeare being a person who hated women, because it just doesn't seem possible.
No, I think he loved women very much. He had many women in his family. His mother, from what we can tell, was a very strong, interesting woman. And while women didn't have the benefit of the same education as men, that potential is just hanging there, isn't it? And their queen was Elizabeth I, who was so educated and so multilingual and amazing. Yeah. How could that, you know, not have inspired the whole generation of women who came next? I kind of think of it along the lines of my own mother, who grew up in a time when she didn't venture to do some of the things I always think she would have done in another era, but she loved what was happening with women while I was growing up, and was so fascinated by women who were the first to do, you know, fill in the blanks. So I kind of think of it in that way, that there was this leader who was inspiring the women of England for what was next, you know?
Yeah, that was, I was thinking, you know, in extension of that, I mean, are there women today that you think embody the values of Anne Hathaway? You know, like who would be her legacy in these times to, as you envision her?
Overall, you know, women who dare, women to dare to do anything that someone suggested they couldn't do. Because Anne asked herself, in my exploration of her, you know, could I do that? Why can't I do that? You know, so much like my own mother, what, you know, could I do that? I don't know if I have the confidence to do that. I see other people doing things now that I haven't tried to do, but in different circumstances. Maybe if Anne had been a woman of means and lived in London, how her life would have been different, right? Or if Will had ever taken her to London and introduced her to his friends and his circle there, it might have been different. We don't believe he did that, but I think she's one of those people who, under different circumstances, again, might have had other possibilities.
So she was like on the verge of potential in an interesting way.
Yeah, her daughter Susanna was the next generation. She had other opportunities and access to information and knowledge. Her husband was an herbalist, Dr. John Hall. Mm-hmm. They had a beautiful home. You can still visit in Stratford. They had a wonderful herbal bed. There's a play called The Herbal Bed that explores some accusations about her possible infidelity. But some think that the character of Helena in All's Well That Ends Well might have been based somewhat on Susanna. Wow. She probably learned a lot working alongside her husband.
So it seems to me we know a little bit about Susanna, but what do we know about Judith?
Judith became enamored with a young man that people would consider a ne'er-do-well. He had been accused of getting a girl pregnant and then not wanting to marry her, apparently, if I have that right. So there were a lot of accusations against him. And Shakespeare actually adjusted his will late in his life so that, because it would be the spouse of a child who would ultimately end up with your wealth and your property, not necessarily the woman, Judith or Susanna themselves. So he did make some changes to his will. And that assured Anne a place to be there with Dr. John Hall and Susanna in New Place after Will's death. And Judith was somewhat written out that way. So she had a daughter, but that was sort of the end of the line, as you might consider it, in that there weren't other people to carry on the direct descendants.
So they had, the kids had kids, but there are no Shakespeares anymore. Are there no people named Shakespeare anymore at all?
Well, there are, but they aren't direct descendants.
Oh, okay. So if,
you know, you went on Dr. Gates, Finding Your Roots, you'd say, no.
That must be cool still in England to be named, you know, Joe Shakespeare.
I would think so. You can have some fun with that. I've been enjoying that program, Shakespeare and Hathaway, about the silly detectives, and it's shot all over Stratford, and their assistant is quite an innovative undercover person because he's an actor. And I just, you know, look at all the scenery and visit Stratford when I watch that show.
Are there any, so if any of our listeners are particularly interested in the women, both in Shakespeare's plays and in Shakespeare's life, do you have suggestions about where they might find more information?
I think there's certainly a lot written about a woman who has become known as the Dark Lady of the Sonnets. There are a lot of references to people in the sonnets who probably are not Shakespeare's wife. But there's a dark, wiry-haired woman that he writes of. And there are a lot of theories about who that woman might have been, and theories about his relationships in London society, and his relationships possibly with men, his dedication of the sonnets to the Earl of Southampton. People like to talk a lot about that. And, you know, but in these times, relationships between men had a different cultural aspect, what they became later, you know, so there was not a term like homosexuality at that time. And there was also, that was also not in the Bible, nor is it still. So these relationships, gender was more fluid, but that's not to say he didn't have affairs or affections. The sonnets seemed to be a lot about infatuation.
What were you going to say, Aaron?
You're calling him a pansexual.
A pansexual.
I presented for a high school out in my home county, and we had a talk back after, and a very cool looking young woman in the audience asked me, and this is one of the rural school districts near where I grew up, asked me if I thought Shakespeare was bisexual. And I had to field that unexpectedly. And my answer was what I said, with gender being more fluid, perhaps we would say that he was. It doesn't mean that he necessarily acted on things, but I think a lot about Jung in relationship to Shakespeare, you know, that he was able to explore those different sides of a human being. Mm-hmm. And Harold Bloom likes to say that Shakespeare invented human personality. Mm-hmm. And that he mined these possibilities in these characters that are just so fascinating. You know, the two sides of the coin, the dark and the light. The new Macbeth film that's come out, there was some wonderful discussion about, you know, what kind of couple these people were. How much they loved each other, you know, hey, they were ambitious, but you know, what were they like a couple? And then they killed people to get where they wanted to get, and you know, crawled over the bodies to get to the top. But, you know, what a fascinating exploration of a marriage that is.
Yeah. Also, I love the relationship between Achilles and Patroclus in Troilus and Cressida.
Achilles and Patroclus, yeah, that's very, you know, overtly loving there.
It's loving.
Yeah.
All these, so many of these plays are just so fascinating. And I've always been fascinated with Juliet and how strong she is.
Yeah, she's
the younger of these two teenagers who fall in love. And that's always an interesting character to explore. One of the very youngest, and in a most complicated situation, and what she takes in hand and decides to do to try to maneuver her own fate. That's amazing. And Lear, who goes, you know, almost literally over the cliff psychologically. And, you know, haven't we seen those things in real life where families just implode over property arguments and simply turn against each other. And meanwhile, you know, an elderly parent is failing. So fascinating.
Yeah, so he runs gamut in terms of women, from Juliet to, like, you know, the Duchess of York, like the really the oldest women who also, she's interesting because she feels very powerless in a terrible way, her son running amok and, you know, whatnot. I don't know. It's fascinating to explore all those different female characters.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole canon, when you, that's why we're still doing these plays today, I believe. Yeah. The whole canon is just full of characters he's created, and then these characters are based in history. There's no shortage of possibilities with that.
Yeah, you were talking about Catherine of Aragon. Would you do a bit of that speech and tell us about that, about her in relation to how you think about her in relation to Anne Hathaway?
Absolutely. I was fascinated by Shakespeare's mining history and things like Holinshed's Chronicles for aspects of his plays. And this particular speech is when Catherine appears in court to defend herself as Henry VIII is trying to divorce her. She decides she can testify and she has a voice. And this speech is based on the actual transcript. And if you watch the show, The Tudors, they used almost word for word what Catherine actually said. And it's very close to this, but Shakespeare makes it more poetic. So she stands up in court and says, "Sir, I desire you do me right and justice and to bestow your pity on me. For I'm a most poor woman and a stranger born out of your dominions, having here no judge indifferent, nor no more assurance of equal friendship and proceeding. Alas, sir, in what have I offended you? What cause hath my behavior given to your displeasure that thus you should proceed to put me off and take your good grace from me? Heaven witness, I have been to you a true and humble wife, at all times to your will conformable, ever in fear to kindle your dislike, yea, subject to your countenance, glad or sorry as I saw it inclined. When was the hour I ever contradicted your desire, or made it not mine too? Or which of your friends have I not strove to love, although I knew he were mine enemy? What friend of mine that had to him derived your anger did I continue in my liking? Nay, gave notice he was from thence discharged. Sir, call to mind that I have been your wife in this obedience upward of 20 years, and have been blessed with many children by you. If in the course and process of this time you can report and prove it too, against mine honor aught, my bond to wedlock, or my love and duty against your sacred person, in God's name, turn me away, and let the foulest contempt shut door upon me, or so give me up to the sharpest kind of justice."
Yeah, you can definitely hear the echoes from the film, you know, from the series, The Tudors. Incredible. She does it almost just exactly like
and
that.
And in the series, she turns on her heel and she walks out, which is just so powerful.
Great, yeah.
So in this speech, what I explored and the time that I use this is when Anne is just at a loss for words of what she could write, because in my play, she is writing to her husband, what she could say to him. By the time she, gets his instructions, she's already done everything that he anticipated she needed to take care of home. She's never quite sure when he's coming back. And sure, she supposes that there are other relationships and other things going on. And in this speech, Catherine is a woman who has tried to do her job, as they say, and provide an heir for Henry, who is obsessed about having a son. And she has not effectively been able to have a child that lives and not a son. So here is Anne, who has lost their son. They have lost their son together. They're grieving for their son. There isn't another son to carry on the name and to be William's heir. Henry wants to divorce Catherine so that he can be with Anne Boleyn and try to have more babies. You know, and Catherine hasn't done anything wrong. And ironically, they've both been married, you know, around the same amount of time when these conflicts are emerging, you know, to be with someone two decades and then cast them aside, as Henry did with Catherine, and change the church of the country, destroy the abbeys and create the Church of England. It's kind of maniacal. So I love the context of this speech and putting these words into Anne's mouth as yet another way for her to explore her own situation in her life with Will.
Wow. Cool.
And I loved in the exploration of this speech, I used it for work I did at Shakespeare and Company. I had the privilege and some funding to help me go up there for a week for what I called Shakespeare Camp. It was the intensive text workshop for a week there in the Berkshires. And this was one of the speeches I worked on. And we worked a lot on line endings, you know, as actors sometimes like to do. And the one I started landing on differently is when she says, "And I have been blessed." She was blessed with many children by him. It was hard to have a baby and, you know, to have a long life. Life expectancies were short. Shakespeare's mother, as I said, buried a lot of babies. That was life in these times.
Yeah, people kind of constantly lived with tragedy just all the time, that they were maybe even inured to it in a different way, especially during plague times, just dead bodies on the street all the time.
Yeah. And there was about a plague when Shakespeare was young. You know, had things been different, we wouldn't even have these plays.
Right. If he had not survived as a baby. He must have thought about that a lot too.
What if? Yeah.
Anything you feel like we didn't hit upon or talk about that you wanted to mention?
Well, I'd love to share this poem that I wrote. Because I've been doing a lot of writing over the years. I have more writing that I want to do about Anne and William. I have a project that's
like a
not fiction. Finished.
Oh, yeah.
I would say this isn't my day job. Someday it might be my day job, but not quite yet. But on one of my trips, I was returning to London on the train, you know, having just explored all the properties and annoyed the tour guides at Anne Hathaway's cottage, trying to get them to tell me new things. And, you know, there wasn't anything new to learn at that point. But I certainly being in that place has informed a lot of my imagination. So I wrote this poem and I share it when Anne is at home by herself and she's doing all the things to keep the household running. Here she is in this huge house that has 10 fireplaces and she's there mostly alone, you know, with her two remaining daughters and maybe some people to help her tend the property, but there she is. And I have her write this letter to him. "Dear William, the flag goes up and voices rise over the crowd. Captivated, enchanted, fascinated. Well, I am not there, for I am here at the Avon, walking alone as I once walked with you. The burden I bear cannot compare to that of Hercules on your great globe's banner. I totter, I stumble, I wait. Walking each day with the love of you in my heart as new as when you wooed, as bright as when you loved, its taste as sweet as when your words did compliment me fine and you did see me fair. What looks, what eyes, what very young heart did prize me? It was my will to love you, my prize to capture, my love to give, but you take it with you to that stage upon which no woman can walk. So here I tread and wait for the flag to fall and the river to bear you home."
Oh, sweet. Very wistful.
And I have him write back and say, "What words you weave. Where did this come from?" I wasn't expecting that of you, Anne. So I couldn't resist having her kind of one up him.
Yeah. Well, you know, after listening for a long time, and she probably would have picked up quite a lot of the rhythms and things whenever he came home. So if people wanted to follow you or be in touch, would you like to tell them places that they can find you?
Absolutely. The most active place is Facebook. And I have a website that has a link there, a modest website, but it does have some more information. Mrs. Shakespeare on Facebook and on email. Anybody has any queries, mrsshakespeare@gmail.com. I'm always looking for booking opportunities and a chance to talk about Shakespeare's life and works and his wife as an expert and someone who spent a lot of time in this field. And the possibilities are endless. Now we're getting out of a time where we have to be indoors and only online. I last performed the show in 2019, so it'll be exciting to get back to it again and to look at how to return live, as they say.
Yeah, and you do the whole thing in full costume and all of that stuff, right?
Yeah, I have full costume, basically, have props, we'll travel.
Yeah.
So it's, fits in the trunk of the car, basically. But I can travel further than that if I have the opportunity.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us.
This has been great. I love the opportunity to talk with both of you. I always love talking about Anne and Will. And this has just been a beautifully time for me to come back to it, as they say.
Yeah. Wow. Let's hope for all of us. All right. Thank you so much, Yvonne. Thanks for joining us.
Take care.
Thank you.
For additional fun shit from Fuck Shakespeare, you can head to our website at fckshakespeare.com.
Or find us on Instagram at fckshakespeare.
If you are enjoying this podcast,
you could support us for as little as 99 cents per month. Just click the support button on the page on Spotify or Anchor.
Tell your friends.